Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, neo-fascism in Brazil and other countries that the United States and its Western allies through neoliberal hegemony and imperial agenda are trying to control, including throughout the Caribbean. To discuss this is Professor Aline Cristina Piva. PIVA. She is an assistant deputy director at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C., and the founder of the organization's Brazil Research Unit. She'll be speaking with us from Venezuela. The Council is a liberal research and information nonprofit. It is dedicated to promoting constructive American and Canadian policies towards Latin American nations. She's also currently a professor of international law at a university in Venezuela. And in the past, Aline has worked in media analysis and political campaigns for a Brazilian-based international communications agency. She also collaborates with the Brazilian political blog Nocturit. She holds a graduate degree in international law from the State University of Londrina and a second higher degree in international affairs from the University of Brasilia, both in Brazil. Her research is focused on democracy in Brazil and U.S.-Cuban foreign relations, in Haiti, and popular Latin American movements. The Council's website is coha.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
We're going to pick up where we left off last week when you were a guest on my noon broadcast. We were discussing the recent Brazilian election that brought the former military officer to power, and he is now the top political person in the country. In and of itself, that wouldn't mean anything, but he is a staunch free trade neoliberal who identifies himself with a fascist or proto-fascist and racist ideology. He's proud of it. He doesn't try to hide it. He has even said that, quote, Trump is an example to me and in many ways to Brazil. Well, earlier you shared how Bolsonaro is an outspoken supporter of anti-abortion laws, charging abortion with criminal penalties. He is an anti-LGBT rights, anti-welfare, anti-minorities, including he's opposed to helping the indigenous people. He supports militarized law enforcement, death squads, to hunt down opponents, torturing, execution, and expanding the war on drugs. Seemingly, he is an ardent climate change denier and threatens to deforest the Amazon to expand industrial agriculture, including lumber and mining, and I assume fossil fuel excavation. Yet the United States government is fully behind him. Our Secretary of State, John Bolton, called him like-minded with the Trump administration. Bolton seems to forget that Brazil had a horrible military dictatorship in the 1980s, which rose due to a U.S.-backed coup in 1964. Bolsonaro idealizes the brutality of the Brazilian dictatorial days. So that is a very brief overview of where Brazil is at this moment. So begin with taking your time to lay out Brazil's potential future if this man is able to get away and implement and enact on his fascist neoliberal policies. And one last overview, and that is when I was in Brazil, I saw back in the 1970s that there were death squads. I think they were called the White Hand at that point. That you had a gross disparity between the have and have-nots. The haves were all on the beaches in the beautiful apartments. The have-nots were just one block behind them. In fact, we were warned, do not walk behind these buildings. It's dangerous. And I said, with all the wealth that you have, why don't you do something to help the poor? He said, that's not the mindset of the Brazilian people. It's not how we think. I thought that was rather bizarre. And this was a very influential policymaker I was speaking with. He was a physician. He was the head of a hospital, and he had deep roots within all the different political movements. He simply was being, he said, honest. He said, I'm not going to sanitize what we do wrong. And we were standing on a building, I'm guessing 5 or 6 stories high, right across from the beach, Ipanema Beach. And I said, look at all that toxic water. And he said, of course it's toxic. Raw sewage goes directly from our apartments untreated right into the ocean. I said, but you pride yourself on being a tourist attraction to bring people from all over the world here to enjoy your beaches, and yet that's a good place to get hepatitis. He said, I know it's a good place to get hepatitis. I'm seeing hepatitis patients every day. He said, but the people who live on the beach never swim in the water. I said, why don't you put in a septic system? He said, because it would mean people would have to care for more than themselves. That's just not our mindset. Now, that could be true or not true. Mm-hmm. I'm only telling you what he personally told me. The form is yours. You've been there. You've lived there. You have a deep history there. And what has gone right and what has gone wrong with Brazil from then till now?
You know, Gary, listening to this story that you just told us and you laying out all that Bolsonaro is and all that he represents, and you were completely right. He's not even apologetic about being that, you know, despicable, awful person, awful human being. It just kind of brings me to this idea that I've been, you know, dwelling with for some time now. What we're seeing now in Brazil is just, you know, he kind of woke up things that were in our society, you know, things that we were never able to fully address, you know, the deep inequality, deep racism, misogyny, all that were there and kind of was channeled by this person. And that did not happen, you know, by chance. It's something designed. It's something that has been, you know, kind of been cooked up in the country for some years now. You know, Brazil, as other countries in Latin America, we are deep and equal countries. And where we have, you know, even though it's not outspoken, or at least it wasn't until a couple of years ago, it wasn't outspoken. But we are countries that have, you know, second-class citizens, or at least the state treated them like this. And in the last, you know, decade and so, and in some countries like Venezuela, like 2 decades now, going on for 2 decades now, we had governments that for the first time in history kind of tried to address what was going on in the country, this deep inequality that many Brazilians faced. And, you know, to have a beach where people doesn't, you know, we don't sanitize this because only people from the outskirts come swim here, you know, it really shows what kind of mentality led the government so far. Brazil, differently from Venezuela, did not have a revolution, but under the Workers' Party government, we had some developments. You know, we gave back some, I don't know, dignity to the people that were, you know, historically forgotten by the state. But what is going on is that Brazil and the whole Latin America got caught in, you know, two struggles. On one hand, we have this deep neoliberal crisis, you know, financial elites all over the world is trying to get back to a point where they were, I don't know, 15 years ago before the 2008 crisis, sorry, and they can't do that. They can't do that because they need to implement this very violent political and economic agenda that doesn't have support of the people anymore. On the other hand, we got caught in this geopolitical fight that is being going on about with the U.S., China, Russia, and Latin America is historically an important place, you know, an important stronghold for U.S. interests and for U.S. power all over the world. And it was important for them to bring down governments that were trying to implement policies that were independent, that did not, you know, automatically aligned with U.S. interests in the region and elsewhere. So I think there are these two things and also a very particularly mindset in Brazil. And, yes?
I'd like to address something you just said and go further into it, because someone listening right now may not appreciate that Brazil is the largest, most powerful economy in South America. It also has a thriving educational system, one of the best in South America. It has more natural resources than any other country in South America, not more oil, that's Venezuela. But it is how it's mismanaged its resources. They've been exploited. And it's not whether there was a liberal in power, because there have been multiple liberals in power, and as we've seen, they've all been corrupt. It's a system where bribes get you into any place you want and get you priority service. So you have these governors throughout the country that run the area that they're overseeing as if they were a dictator. It's almost a feudal system, as if you were to go back to France and the king, Louis the 13th's father, had virtually no control over all these royalty. They did what they wanted. And now you have a country whose resources have been exploited by China and Japan and the United States, but not in a way that is renewable and that supports the indigenous people or the people of Brazil. Instead of making this wonderful country prosper for everyone and sustain it, it's just been an open market privatization, and I don't give a damn who's in power. They're all corrupt. And part of the problem is in the United States, we think because someone who's called liberal is elected that that means it's going to be for the people and for the environment. Nothing could be further from the truth. So I'd like for you to take us on an honest, legitimate story, one that no ambassador, no foreign dignitary would dare tell you the truth about how great a country was and what it did to destroy its own Amazon, its own rainforest, its own fertile soil, the displacement of its own people, the death squads, and this has been going on for a long time. Please continue.
Yes, that is true. That is true, but when they first found out about pre-salt, which is the, you know, second largest oil reserves in Latin America, we are just behind Venezuela on that. One of the things that Dilma and Lula implemented was that 70% of that revenue, the exploitation of those oil reserves, would have to go for education and healthcare in the country. They also developed a program of course, there is no way we can have, you know, you can exploit oil resources without having, taking a toll on the environment. But they implemented kind of a program to try to minimize that impact as much as the technology in Brazil allow it to. And one of the first things that they did after the 2016 coup against Dilma Rousseff was to, you know, eliminate that program. Now, what we are seeing in Brazil is a rollback to what we had before the Workers' Party. For example, the Workers' Party implemented that the agribusiness would not be allowed to buy land in the Amazon. International capital could not buy land in the Amazon. Now, you know, the whole country is open for business. They are not being held to and accountability. They can do whatever they want, because what they are doing is to just roll back Brazil to being, you know, open for business for anyone who wants to come in. But I would also like to address the subject of corruption. I think there is this, I don't know, I understand that the system is rigged. It is. It really is. But I think that there is a kind of blown out of proportion idea about what is corruption in Latin America. And I think there is also kind of a bias understanding of what is corruption. Because when you look at Brazil, for example, corruption is a historical problem in the country, but it has only been, in the news cycle during the Workers' Party government. And there are two reasons for that. One, because that was the only government that actually allowed the institutions in the country that are in charge of, you know, prosecuting and fighting corruption to do their jobs. And also because there was an instrumentalization of corruption. All parties are involved in corruption at some levels. We have a couple of that are not, because they are fairly new in the political scene of the country. But there are parties such as Temer's MDB or even Bolsonaro's PSL that have been involved in corruption since the military dictatorship, you know. But they don't talk about that. They only talk about the corruption on the left. They only talk about the corruption on the Workers' Party, even though there are, you know, comparatively much less politicians from the Workers' Party involved in corruption than of any other parties from the right, you know. And then you see corruption being used in Latin America as an excuse for international intervention, just as we saw the war on drugs. In this case, this recent case that is called car wash operation, what we see, there was legal cooperation between Brazilian authorities and the Department of Justice. It's intervention, you know, it goes against our sovereignty, and it's something that it needs to be addressed. There is this whole new wave of soft coups going on. And we saw, you said, and, you know, the last time we had a dictatorship in the country, it was 21 years of, you know, open brutality. What can we expect now that they are fully backed and they have this, you know, so-called backup of the elections, that there are, you know, we can raise serious questions about its legitimacy.
Aileen, we also have to look at the fact that for those of us, myself included, who every week study world economic trends, and for over 25 years, Brazil was one of the leading producers of products exported to other countries that kept his gross domestic product very high, much higher than the United States. As far as a percentage of growth, it was right up there by India. It's just that the profits were not used in a way that helped everyone and helped advance the causes of human rights and the Amazon. Excuse me. Right now, the most serious threat anywhere on the planet is if the Amazon is depleted any further of its carbon sink capacity. It is the lungs of the planet. If they continue to tear down the rainforest at more than a football field every minute, then within 2 years from now, you will see an increase in global warming because of that, and dryness in large parts of the world, and excessive rain in other parts of the world that will bring suffering on an unimaginable level, not the least of which will be to Brazil itself. So it's something that I believe should be addressed. That's why we're doing this program. But I also want to not forget that there are other countries that are run by people who are corrupt and from the far right and fascistic. The United States under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and the CIA and our national security state engineered or supported a coup in Honduras. No one in the mainstream media has challenged them on that. The consequences were unionists were killed. One of the most famous women unionists in Aline, any noise you make is coming across on the microphone, please. So we want to look at other countries as well, including Venezuela, because right now even the mainstream media, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, have not positioned Hugo Chavez as an important contributor to peace and stability and social safety nets for the poor and working class in this country. He's projected successfully in a public relations campaign as being this vile, emotionally unstable person, and his so-called socialist government is causing people to eat dog food or move out of the country. And the truth of what's actually happening and what did happen under Chavez has been completely excluded from all talking points. So would you give us some background on what Hugo Chavez did and what Venezuela was like to live there prior to his taking power, and then what it was like during his presidency?
So, you know, just on the Amazon, I would like to say something. You know that Brazil has this movement that is called the Landless Workers Movement. It's the hugest, you know, the largest popular movement in Latin America, over 150,000 families. And what they do is they advance the idea that only sustainable agriculture is, you know, only with sustainable agriculture we will be able to save our country. You know, the level of consumption that we have today is not sustainable. We cannot go on like that. And one of the first things that happened after Bolsonaro was elected, they passed a law trying to criminalize the movement. There was 450 families in Minas Gerais, traditional black community families, they were being evicted today. 20 years of agriculture, they produced over 50 tons of coffee, organic coffee a year, and they are being evicted, criminalized. So you see, it's not only that they are open up Brazilian resources to international big business, but they are also criminalizing the idea of sustainable production, of people fighting back years of responsible exploitation of the country. So I think that's very symbolic What is also very symbolic is the way mainstream media portray Bolsonaro and portray Chavez. When you were talking about how mainstream media, you know, made people believe that Chavez was this awful person, everything, I was thinking about how they portray Bolsonaro. Because yes, they have some criticism and they say, okay, it's not okay to say that. But they also say, well, he might be acceptable because he's going to be good for business. And that bring us back to Venezuela, you know, why it is so important for the mainstream media to demonize what is going on here, what Chavez represented, what the Bolivarian revolution is. They are trying to build here, and it's a process. It has, you know, problems. It's struggling mostly because of U.S. sanctions. You know, they are taking a toll on Venezuelan people. But what Chavez did is that he took a country that was deeply unequal, that did not produce anything, and he gave the power back to the people. You know, people here in Venezuela, they have this profound commitment with the revolution because each and every one of them, of course, there are the opposition that are trying to go back to, you know, a time previous. It's only natural. But when you talk to the people on the streets, they have this notion of how important it is to take back responsibility for their own lives, their own future, their choices, and how they can, you know, really make a better world, trying to change the system, you know. Venezuela, for example, when you talk about consumption, one of the things that I lived in the U.S. for 4 years, so I know how they show supermarkets, you know, empty shelves and everything. And that's true. You go to the supermarkets and you don't see, it's not like you were entering a Walmart where you can buy anything from tires to tomatoes. It's not like that. But we are going back to buying organic in the streets at fair prices, not overpriced products. People are, you know, producing their own food. We are going back to a sustainable economy, But we also need to address why it is so important for the United States to sanction the Venezuelan people, because they say they are sanctioned, you know, government officials, but they are actually implement an economic and diplomatic blockade, just like they did with Cuba.
Go through what life was like for the rich, the professional class, and the average working class and the poor prior to the revolution. And then how was, I don't want to ask a question answered. I'd like for you to do very detailed, because I can give you a lot of statistics of how many schools, how much free medicine he gave, how many buildings he built specifically for the poor. All the cooperatives he started around the country. But I want you to answer this in detail. No more platitudes, just details, please.
Okay, so in the 80s, just before the Caracaso, there was a shortage of dog food. And when they went to see what was going on, they realized that people that lived in the outskirts of the city, they called it here barrios, they were eating dog food because they could not get access to protein, to animal protein. So they had to eat dog food. We are talking about a country that since the 50s, when they discovered oil here, and they stopped all they stopped all, you know, industrial, they kept some, but they started to rely only in oil exploitation. That create a kind of a two countries. We had this, the elites that were the ones, you know, directors and executives of oil industry, and they created a movement from people coming from the small cities in the interior of the country to big cities just like Caracas or Maracaibo, where they were, you know, oil centers for exploitation. So what happened there is that those cities did not have infrastructure enough to get those people, you know, so that those people could have any kind of dignity, any kind of, you know, acceptable standards of living. And then you see that we did not have enough university, enough services, enough, the unemployment rates were huge. And what we had here was this economy we called shopping center economy that did not produce anything. When Chavez came into power, he had to restructure all of that. Include services, include housing, education, healthcare. That was a huge development for, you know, a country that did not had thinking about that before Chavez came into power.
Okay. Now, give us a rundown of how he used the largest oil reserves in the world, larger than Saudi Arabia or Russia, for the people. And especially when oil was at around $115 a barrel, yeah, he was able not only to help his own people, but he actually was helping other countries, including Cuba, with their problems. And he has never given credit for the humanitarian work that he did around the world. He did not, from at least what I can see, I looked into his personal background, he did not live a life of extravagance. He didn't have the big villas. He didn't have the jewelry. He lived a very simple and almost an aesthetic life. Give us your perspective. Give us your perspective, please.
Even in the U.S., right? Because when they had this shortage, I think it was in South Bronx. I'm not sure if it was Harlem or South Bronx in New York. The mayor decided to cut down subsidized heating oil for those communities. And what Chavez did is that he demanded the CITGO, which is, you know, a state-owned U.S.-based oil company. Kind of that. It's not that simple, but, you know, kind of that. He demanded that CITGO subsidize it, heating oil for those communities in need in New York. That is something that people does not talk very much. Chavez was a humanist, you know. He believed in international solidarity, and he believed that, you know, one people's struggle was, you know, all people's struggle. So even in countries that do not supported him, that did not, you know, supported the revolution, he always said, our commitment is to the people. And he did that. He created Petrocaribe, for example, to help communities all over, you know, poor islands here in the Caribbean. They did not. And this is something really interesting. You mentioned Cuba. The kind of diplomacy that Cuba, Venezuela tried to establish is not regular diplomacy, you know, quid pro quo diplomacy. It's the diplomacy based in needs. What can I give you? What do you need? What can you give me back? So, for example, Cuba does not have, you know, other sources of, you know, really good other sources of energy rather than oil. They use it in the whole island. Venezuela has oil. Cuba has, you know, physicians. What they did, they consolidate a strategy where Venezuela gave Cuba oil. In exchange, Cuba sent here to Venezuela doctors so they could, you know, address the lack of doctors in the country. And one of the first things that Chavez did here, so he could implement that plan, was to nationalize oil resources, the oil reserves. And of course, that, you know, gave him a lot of enemies. And some are still trying to get back to Venezuela. You see, for example, some oil companies like Chevron and others. And the one that Tillerson was, Exxon, was that the one that Tillerson was CEO for some time? They are now demanding Venezuela for, you know, reserves in the Orinoco, Arch, and things like that. So you see that it's so connected.
The United States, Great Britain, France, and other countries have intentionally placed sanctions against Venezuela so that the people, not the rich, not the powerful, suffer. And as they suffer and have to go without, then they will take in a CNN and show you empty shelves and say this is the real cost of socialism. And the right in particular, the alt-right, is saying, is this what you want? Well, right here in the United States, we do not have capitalism. That is a myth. We have socialized capitalism, which means that every major corporation that fails, and most do, we bail them out. We subsidize them. We subsidize the entire energy cartels from nuclear to gas to oil. We give gas allowances, oil allowances. And so they've been given hundreds of billions of dollars a year in tax breaks and incentives. And then the quantitative easing, not a penny of that went to the small businesses nor to the average American. That's how utterly corrupt we are. You see, we're a rich banana republic, but we act the same way these other banana republics act. Now, I want to take an exception with Cuba, and I'd like to have you, you've been to Cuba many times, I assume, right?
To Cuba one time, but I have stayed there, stayed them for quite some time now.
Okay. I wanted to see for myself, since so many of my friends had gone down to Cuba to help with the Castro's efforts to challenge the United States and the embargoes by working in the cane fields. I went with a different mindset. I wanted to see what life was like if you were not accepting a preordained ideological mindset. And of course, the moment you step into a mindset, everything is filtered. You no longer see something for what it is. So when I went, I was fortunate enough to have two different people who escorted me throughout the island during my stay. One's parents were the former directors of the KGB in Cuba, and they also were, in his family, were the so-called execution judges, meaning right after the revolution, people were tried if they were perceived to be enemies of the state or Batista's, the former dictator, is if they were friends or allied with him. In any case, when you're driving hours on end from one end of the country to the other, and you're stopping everywhere, but not in hotels, but staying with average people, you have a chance to see what people are like. Because in every one of the hotels, there's an older woman at the end of every hall monitoring everything you do. And I was told every phone is tapped. There's nothing you can do that they're not aware of. So I wanted to go off the grid, and I did. And I saw that there is rampant racism. And it was acknowledged, but it's something they don't want the world to know. And those who are favored and those who are not. Fidel was not Hugo Chavez. They're not in the same league. I'm not a supporter of Fidel Castro. I think that he brought unnecessary suffering to his people for his own ideological and emotional needs. I saw and heard the stories of people in positions to know, including the top medical doctor in the top hospital, that if you saw Michael Moore's movie, Sicko, it made it look like it was a utopian medical paradise. He said that was all show. He said the reality is different. You could wait a year before you get treated, and most of the people give up and go to other Caribbean nations like Jamaica and buy in the black market their medications, frequently bringing them back. He said it's not this utopian place. And he said the older individuals have accepted that this is the best it's going to be, and whatever subsidies they get, whatever allowances they're given, they accept it. The younger people don't want to be there. I interviewed over 100 young people, and that's the last place they want to be because they're not stupid. They do have access to the internet. They do see what's going on around the world. And one of the things I kept asking, not one exception, every single town we went through from one, and by the way, if you've never been to Cuba, you could put Cuba over California and you wouldn't see any of California. That's how big that place is. And you have places where factories could be manufacturing concrete. You could rebuild. And I said, why aren't you rebuilding? Why is everything dilapidated? Yes, I can understand certain parts and things, but you've been trading with Russia for decades and then with China and with Canada and with Germany. And in fact, when I did go by some of the hotels, I wanted to see what the resorts were like. There's almost nobody there, but it was too expensive for anyone except the people like the German resorts. And they're like any other resorts in the Caribbean. But I give you just one example. I stayed at a man's house, and there was no air conditioner. There was no fan working. The water didn't work. It dripped out, and it was dark. And I said, how long has it been like this? And he just smiled. He said, long time. The mattress was an old smelly mattress, not because he was dirty. It's just that he couldn't afford another mattress. This is probably 40 years old. The box springs, I just finally just laid on the floor. But I'm watching him take out a piece of pork from this little refrigerator. And then I watch him as he takes a razor blade and he's slicing it. And it kind of reminded me of that scene in The Goodfellas where the guys are in prison and they're finally slicing the garlic. And that's what he was doing. And I'm thinking, my goodness, this poor man is giving me, as his guest, he's given me some of his ration. And his rations are meager at best. So I went over and I said, no, don't do that for me. I'm a vegan. And the next morning, and in fact, every place I stayed, I would take them to their local farmers markets and I would fill up the whole van to the gills with food so they'd have plenty of food. And you could buy a bucket, a gallon bucket of mangoes for a quarter. You could buy a watermelon for a quarter. Very inexpensive, the food. But nothing worked. It was a nation where the people's will, the desire, had been broken because it was a stiff consequence. If you challenged Fidel, there were no free speeches, there was no free press, there was no freedom to assemble, and everyone was spied upon. And mind you, the head of the KGB was telling me this. It's not as if this was some hearsay. So unlike most Americans, and especially those from the left who idolize Fidel and idolize Che Guevara, who was a rampant racist, he hated black people. My God, when are people going to stop rewriting the truth of this man and show him for what he was? He was so rabid and so radical, that's why he was no longer in Cuba. They even threw him out of Russia. He was against Khrushchev for compromising on the Bay of Pigs. He'd rather seen a nuclear confrontation. That's how far off the deep end he was. But anyhow, everybody loves his T-shirts today, and they don't need to know about truth for some reason. But I was there, and I got a whole different picture of Castro, his corrupt regime, and what he did to so many innocent people. And the left would like to believe that everyone in Miami and everyone who came here, somehow they were all capitalist, and it's not true. And I'm almost embarrassed and ashamed by how much the American public has been misled about the truth of what has happened in Cuba. I'd like your thoughts now, please.
You know, I spent a little over a month in Cuba. I don't know when you were there. I was there a couple years ago. And I had a completely different impression for of the country. No, it's a country that has its problems. We are talking about a country that has been under siege for over 50 years now. They trade, but they trade in what currency? What are the exchanges? What are they, how are the impositions that were made to the people? And as far as Fidel and other leaders, I think it, you know, revolutions, they don't start in a vacuum. They come upon and the conditions for a revolution and the conditions for a revolution to sustain itself, they are historically made. The Cuban Revolution is not the same as the Venezuelan Revolution. They started in different time frames. They started in different historical contexts. You cannot have someone, a lot of people always say, how the Cuban Revolution treated the homosexuals. I mean, what country can, truly say they had a good policy for LGBT community in the 50s? It's something we cannot be revisionists. We have to see things for what they are. And we also have to see that, yes, there is a lot of mismanagement, but one, give the chance for Cuba or Venezuela to develop, their revolutions to its fully capability, to what they really can be. And then we can talk. And then we can talk about what it is. What I saw in Cuba, there are two things. You talk about the youth, and it's true. And it's true because we are talking about, a part of the society that did not know, they were born in revolution, and that's all they know. And as any young people, they want to see the world, they want to see things for themselves. And that is, that is a legitimate feeling, sentiment. But I mean, you also see people that are highly educated, people that are that can be themselves to the fully extent of their capabilities. They can develop themselves as human beings. There are hardships. Of course, we are talking about an island. An island that did not produce everything that they need. They had some products, but they did not, they were not known to be, to raise animals for consumption. They imported everything. So yes, it's true. Some things are hard, but we need to see why are that, what is the source of their hardship? Just like here in Venezuela, why can't I go to the pharmacy and buy medicine? Because there is a blockade. Sanctions are real.
Okay, good. I'm glad you set your position here, because you're answering me as if you were an ideologue. I'd like to just differentiate, and then we'll go on to another topic here. In Cuba, you could not do what you wanted to do. You did anything. In Venezuela, you can. If you want to go to school, you can go to school. The work that is available, you can do it if you're capable and if you're qualified. And you had freedom. Hugo Chavez did not demand everyone pay allegiance. He didn't do a six-hour lecture and expect everyone to, you know, surround listening to his lectures. And diatribes, they're completely different. They both struggled, but in my opinion, the left has made a really egregious error in how they've praised Fidel and put all the blame upon all the people who were against him and tried to overthrow him and wanted to kill him. And that is true, versus what he did to limit his own people and to ride roughshod. And his prisons were always full of political prisoners. And that truth is just not going to come out in the liberal media in the United States, or for that matter, it's not going to come out anywhere. Anyhow, on this position, you and I share just a difference of opinion. That's all. But something we do share, something more in common, is going back to Brazil. What are the other Latin American countries fearing or saying with this radical change in Brazil's government? And as a member of the BRIC trading nations, Brazil and Russia and India and also South Africa, Brazil is certainly an economic powerhouse still. And are other Latin American countries experiencing a rise in the popularity of far right-wing political parties? And is there a chance that Bolsonaro's election having a domino effect on other countries? And will we witness other Latin nations swinging to the far right or even the extreme right?
Again, just as in Cuba, there is a historical context to everything, and no analysis can be, you know, fully address it without put them in historical context. The rise of, far-right extremists and governments, not only in Latin America, but also in other countries, in other regions throughout the world, it is within historical context. It's a historical context of a deep crisis, you know, a very profound crisis of neoliberalism. And it's important for, you know, those interests to be readdressed through violent means. I mean, in Brazil we had a coup d'etat. In Argentina it wasn't as open a coup d'etat. It was more a mediatic coup that put in power a person that is leading the country to an extreme social crisis. So yeah, it's we are all, you know, fruits of our historical context.
I'm just concerned right now because Ecuador has a president, new president, who is acquiescing to Donald Trump and his State Department in order to get favored trading status again and open up new lines of commerce. They're willing to throw Julian Assange to the under the bus. And in my opinion, Julian Assange is simply one of the most important journalists in the history of the world, and the American journalists of the world have turned their back on him. That does not surprise me. And those who have stood up for him, like Chris Hedges, Abby Martin, Cornel West, and people I have a lot of respect for, they're concerned. My concern is that very shortly he'll have no choice. He'll be thrown out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He'll be arrested by the British. He'll be extradited to the United States. And he will seek to address these issues, and they could even bring him under the National Defense Authorization Act, which gives him no rights whatsoever. And when Barack Obama signed that, it's just a very troubling time, both in South America, Central America, Mexico, and the United States. But I do appreciate the concerns you have, what you're doing to raise these concerns and put a voice behind these in the countries that you have some standing in. And thank you very much for coming on our program today and sharing your insights.
Thank you, Gary.
Professor Aline Christine Piva, and she was here to talk about what most of us never would know because our media doesn't cover these struggles at all. We just seem disinterested in anything except what's right in her mindset on this day at this moment, not realizing that there are events occurring that can impact the global future, global warming, economic considerations. And we all want one thing. We all want peace, happiness, long life, and a way of living in a moral and ethical world. Unfortunately, that is not always the same agenda of those in power. Thank you for listening, everyone. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now? Brother, what's up? This is a good recording, man. Yeah, brother, I can dig it. Stop right on.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've